Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, and I've got a great, great show for you guys today. So thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us. We have the Grateful Dead from August 4th, 1994 in Giant Stadium. And although that date may be a little bit out of whack for the show that with today's date, we're doing it because we are very lucky to also have with us a guest, Mr. Christian Sauska, who is coming to us, and we will be chatting with him in a few minutes. He was at this show that we're featuring today, which is why we're featuring it, and he's going to talk with us about all sorts of stuff, the music that he makes, New Orleans-style music, his recollections of the Grateful Dead, and other fun things that I'm sure we will get to during our show. But let's dive right into August 4th, 1994, Giants Stadium, and this is what they opened with. Walk into a Dead show and they open up with Box of Rain, you give yourself a little pat on the back and said, I came on the right day. That worked out just fine for me. And unfortunately, I wasn't there, and I never made it inside a Giants Stadium in East Rutherford or anywhere they had it. But Christian did. Christian, welcome to our show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Similarly, I was excited to be at that show. It was, in fact, my first.
Everybody has one, and that's not a bad first show to go to. You know, Giants Stadium has been known to be the home of some of the finest summer Dead shows out there, and for many a year hosted the Dead on their annual East Coast Summer Swings. You know, playing to upwards of 60,000 plus people. All New Yorkers, and I'll withhold my comments on that, but anybody who's ever been to an East Coast Dead show knows exactly what I'm talking about. And you know, it was funny because, you know, Dan asked for this show because you had been there. And I said, sure, that's great. We can do it. And I started to read the reviews of it. And I'm going to tell you right now that, you know, some of these Deadheads are just an entitled bunch of, I won't even get into it, right? Oh, anything after 93, I won't listen to. I was there, but I don't count that. And I don't, Jerry's fat and this and that. And I'm like, of course, absolutely. But you know what? There were 60,000 people there that day and the next day and the day after that. The whole rest of the tour was sold out. And they sold out right through the final show at Soldier Field. Sometimes it was painful. Sometimes you need to kind of winced a little bit. But Jerry fucking Garcia, for God's sakes. And, you know, anybody who wasn't happy with that, then, you know, look, you must have fallen off the bus somewhere along the way and not made it all the way back. One other thing to note about this recording today is that it is an audience tape. So we do pick up some ambient conversation and other stuff like that in the background, which to me just makes it more genuine because if you've been to a show, people around you are talking all the time anyway. Christian, this raises the obvious question. What got you to your first Grateful Dead show?
Well, I grew up in Connecticut. I'm a New England prep school kid. I went to private school. I was not a Deadhead. There were kids in my group who said they were into the Grateful Dead, and I thought they were crazy lunatics and didn't understand why they would, I didn't think they knew what they were talking about. And then I was probably never one to say no very often. That's not one of my best traits, as Dan can probably attest to. And one of my buddies became one of my closest, dearest friends, and was certainly ended up on the bus with me. We said we were going. So the two of us took off. We went to East Rutherford, didn't have a ticket, got a ticket in the parking lot, was looking at everything, taking it all in. We had fun, made a lot of the same mistakes. I think if you look, this is, you know, Traffic opened, Jerry came on, they did Dear Mr. Fantasy. I may have told some people at some point that we were there, but we were not there for that. We didn't know what we were doing. I was not a deadhead at this point. You know, made some mistakes in the parking lot. Luckily made it home safe. Everything was fine. And then, you know, I don't know if it's weird, not weird. My journey, let's say, did not begin until after Jerry died and it hit me in the face and it hit me hard. So, you know, that's, but so I made it to two shows total, but not with any of the excitement I had, let's say, when I went to go, you know, if I went to even not when I went to the Grateful Dead 50th anniversary shows in Chicago, that was like that was, there was an excitement and an emotion there that I certainly did not have in my first show, because I wasn't on the bus yet. I might have seen it coming, but I didn't get on.
Well, you know, that's, I think, what happens to everybody in their first shows. And, you know, some people got on the bus very late and they didn't start seeing shows until 94 or 95. And for them, you know, that's the whole body of live Grateful Dead music that they have to work with. And so I'm sure that they look at it a little bit differently than some of us jaded guys who had already been seeing them, you know, for 10 to 15 years by that point. And forget about me, right? There were people who had been seeing them for 25, 30 years and maybe even farther back than that. And although, you know, we were all respectful of Jerry and understood that, you know, he wasn't entirely healthy and he was out there kind of trooping on, you know, there still wasn't really this sense that, like, well, the final curtain's about to come down on them or anything. And then it did. And I think it gave everybody a whole lot of appreciation. By the time they pulled it all together for the 2015 50th reunion show, I think it did spark a lot of energy in a positive way, because, you know, a lot of deadheads who never really felt that they had a sense of closure with the Grateful Dead because they had seen them somewhere on the 94 or 95 tour, you know, decided, yeah, this isn't really what I've been hearing on my buddy's tapes. I don't know if I'm going to keep going back or not. And then, like you say, finally have a chance to sit down and listen to a wide body of the work and realize, wow, this is great, great music. And I missed out on it. And 2015 gave people a great opportunity to catch up on that. And, you know, people have their differences of opinions and feelings about Dead & Co., but, you know, they played strong for 7 or 8 years. And I always enjoyed going to the shows. You know, like, I've been very open about the fact that I wasn't always wild about the arrangements or the way they played some of the songs. But on the other hand, they played the songs and they played them in the environment where you want to hear it, with all the other deadheads around and with as many of the surviving members as they could bring together under one roof and still keep peace in the family, apparently. But that's a whole deadhead thing that, inner circle thing that those of us who are just deadheads on the outside could speculate about.
But we never had to speculate all we want.
Right. We never really had to know what was going on. But, you know, I got to say, for your first show, you know, to come out strong with A Box of Rain, that's like, that's a good sign. You know, my first show was Bertha. There's certain songs that are just meant to be first songs at your first show. And if you get it, I think the good karma just flows right along with you. And it did in this show, apparently, because the very next song they played is another one of my favorites. Okay, so you're at your first show. It's like Box of Rain, check. Jack Straw, check. That, you know, most deadheads probably have to go to 5, 10, 15 shows before they get to see songs like that.
Yeah. I was with my buddy Bill. We were in the car. He might have known more songs than I did at this time. And we were saying, we just want to know a couple of songs. If we know a few songs, then it's a win. And it's like, bam, bam. Holy crap. This is awesome. It was, I remember that feeling. So everything else was lanyap, as we say down here afterwards.
Right. No, you know what? It was awesome. And it was, you know, even years later, you know, going to a show towards the end of the run and, you know, you'd see them come out like this, 94, Box of Rain, Jack Stride. You never get tired of it. You never grow that emotion never grows old. You never wear out of it. It's just, wow, the boys are really kicking tonight. And, you know, maybe kicking for 94 wasn't the same as kicking for 77 or, you know, 85. But, you know, for those of us that were still checking them out in 94 and supporting the band, they were great. And, you know, we enjoyed all of it. And, you know, they could play a song like Jack Straw and still just, you know, kick butt with it and get that energy going. And you can feel, you can hear them on stage when Jerry's enjoying himself and not going through one of these, oh God, I got to drag my way through.
I mean, I think that's everything. If he was in a good mood, everything was going to be running totally well. And I, you know, I'm sure I've at some points in my life been the picky guy or wanting to be a little snotty at times, and the later stuff isn't as good. But if I look back at it, it was a 1993 show that I was listening to that absolute, like, it was the fishhook that pulled me in. And yep. I probably myself don't listen to the late 80s and 90s stuff as much as I would do the 70s stuff. But
sure,
I don't know that I feel too guilty for it.
No, you know? Look, that's the beauty of being a deadhead. You know, there's different eras. Some yeah. deadheads are specifically attracted to one. You know, a lot of folks don't believe the Grateful Dead existed past 1969 or 70. You know, when they put what, you know, my co-host Rob and I always call Primal Dead, and Dave Lemieux calls it that too. So we're not trying to claim credit for that, Dave. We get it that you've done it as well. But Primal Dead, you know, which is wonderful stuff, and I love that era. I also happen to love the Americana era that flowed out of that. But some people say, hey, when Tom Constanton left the group and they put away the psychedelics in that regard and went under the other stuff, they were okay, but that's not the real Grateful Dead. And some, you know, people say, if you didn't see him in 73, 74, 77, you know, 78, you never saw him.
No.
Okay,
no.
I, you know, but I had to see him when I see him. And, you know, I've got no complaints. And although I sure would have been fun to see them back when I could, within the 30-year period when they were playing, I feel damn lucky to have, you know, kind of dropped down right in the middle of it. And, you know, really had a chance to see a good number of those shows and, you know, really get a chance to experience it. And, you know, you too, once you see a show, it doesn't matter how many you've seen it, you know what people are talking about. You can join the conversation.
Absolutely. And actually this might be a good opportunity for me to talk. I have this guilt sometimes. We're talking about, you know, early 70s. I'm listening and it's like, oh, this. It works so well, and there's an experimentation to it and a rawness, but it's still a big energy. But I almost feel bad because a lot of the shows I end up liking is Mickey wasn't in the band, right? Is when his little hiatus was going on, and I almost feel guilty how much I enjoyed some of those shows. I don't know that it would have been different if he was there, if it wouldn't have been better if he was there. I don't have that kind of opinion, but there is almost. Why do I feel that way? I have a hard time coming to terms with it.
You know, I think that, you know, those of us that, you know, for whom the Grateful Dead are defined as, you know, the six guys between the 80s and the 90s, just switching out Vince Welnick for Brent when it became necessary to do so, unfortunately. You know, that's who we really think of. You know, when they played in 2015 and they didn't invite Vince back to them, but I discovered that, you know, Jeff Comenti, who I had heard before, but really in those shows, in my opinion, you know, really rose to the top as one of the ultimate keyboard players who could play with them. And you say, boy, where was he after Brent died? You know, but I saying that, I loved Vince and I loved the way he performed in the 90s. But yeah, you do wind up feeling a little bit guilty about that, I think, because we like to think of them as a collective whole. You know, as far as Mickey goes, you know, my feelings are very simple. Look, his father came in and screwed the band. Now, whether that was Mickey's fault or not, I'm going to err on the side of saying I don't think it was, but, you know, who knows? But either way, Mickey felt like he needed a breather. Maybe the band felt like they needed a breather. Either way, off he went, and, you know, Kreutzmann stepped in and did the job admirably. And, you know, I think credit to all of them is during that period of time, Kreutzmann's drumming is just absolutely stupendous. He really drives that band and does a fine job of doing it solo. But I think, you know, some people might be forgiven if they sat there and listened to it. And the way that he and Mickey so seamlessly drum together, sometimes it's hard to tell that it's just one drummer. You have to know what period it is and what's going on, I think, in some of these instances to really be able to pick up on the fact you know, as well as Kreutzmann could play, but more importantly, as well as they all play together. And, you know, I think credit to Kreutzmann and the rest of the band that when Mickey was ready to come back, they were ready to have him back. Everybody benefited from it. And, you know, he's still there today, you know, doing his thing.
And we got the Rhythm Devils. I mean, you can't, nobody's complaining. But actually, this reminds me, there was a, the Grateful Dead channel, Sirius Radio, the Tales from the Golden Road.
Sure.
We're allowed to talk about this, right?
Absolutely. We love David
Gibson. And I've always wanted to call in and never quite did. I was dropping my son off at a soccer game. It was an hour early. It just comes on. I said, I'm calling. And, you know, couldn't get through, get on. And the reason I wanted to call them, I did end up getting on. We had a great conversation, was that I have, you know, my kids and my wife don't always want to listen to the Grateful Dead radio, it's Sirius Radio. And, but I made it a game. I said, all right, if it's a live show, I'm going to guess from within 2 years when it was going to be. And that's, is it one drum or is it two drums? All right, there's not a gene. Okay, good. But the reason I called is because I didn't have any tricks for the 80s, right? I mean, you tell people who are uninitiated, 65 to 95, it's 30 years of live music. I'm going to tell you within 2 years when that song was played, it sounds impressive, but there's a lot of little tricks. But the 80s killed me. It killed me. And they pointed out on when I called in that it was the longest period of a sustained lineup that didn't change, right? So that made sense. The only thing they could come up with was that after the coma, Brent put something into his keys, had a different kind of sound. I don't even remember what they said. I should figure that out. But even they said that it's hard in the 80s to figure out, you know, when it was. But it was still a fun game. That was a fun phone call.
Oh, first of all, we've had David Gans on the show, and he's a wonderful guy. We haven't had Gary Lambert yet, but maybe one of these days we'll be lucky enough to get him too. Sure, their Sunday show, I think, is almost required listening for Deadheads, because in order to, you know, really build up this base of knowledge and understanding and feeling about the Dead, there's nothing better than hearing the stories of other Deadheads. Some of them are, you know, long and boring. Others of them are really short and absolutely amazing. But you hear this and you hear the way other Deadheads have processed this whole experience, not just the music, but, you know, I love their stories. Well, I picked up my buddy and we went here, and some people are like, I don't want to hear about that. No, I do want to hear about that, because I had those long road trips with buddies, and those were always an integral part of everything that happened. You know, there was the musical part, and then everything else, the travel part. We have to eat, we got to sleep, we got to, you know, and you do all of it. And so, you know, they're really a lot of fun to listen to as well. For the 80s, I think that's true. I think that Brent became a little more aggressive the second half of the 80s in terms of his playing and his singing. Well, one thing is, at the beginning of the 80s, Phil was not singing. By the end of the 80s, Phil was singing. So if you pick up a Phil song, you already know you're in the second half of the month, second half of the year, of the decade, I should say, right? But
there you go. I like that. That's a nice little,
right? So if you pick up Phil singing, that eliminates, you know, that gets you at least to 84 or 85 when he started doing Tom Thumb's Blues.
Right.
And then Box of Rain in 86. And from then on in, he was always singing. But I also think part of it just has to be the song selection. And that's hard. If you're listening to Uncle John's Band, that may be very tough, right, to discern.
Yeah.
But if you're listening to Built to Last, then you know you're talking about 88, 89 or somewhere in there.
Right.
And
song selection can be a part, yes, for sure.
So, but yeah, in terms of actual sound, I think it does get difficult during that period. We all have tricks, right? If you're listening to They Love Each Other and it's that fast, upbeat, snappy version, that's 1973. That's the only year they ever played it that way.
Right.
And you know, when you hear Dark Star, and at the very beginning, you hear like those little maracas scratching together. That's 1968 and 69. They always started Dark Star that way during that period of time. And, you know, I mean, we could sit here and go through and pull out all of these, but I love to play that game. And in fact, what I do is, and I don't know if you listen to Fish at all, I enjoy Fish now, and I've come to like them because my kids are into them so much that I thought, you know, it would be fun to get into them and see some shows with them as well. But the difference is that Fish has been playing the same songs more or less the same way all the way through. They didn't really have a Primal Fish and a Americana Fish and and so, you know, when they play Possum is Possum, and you know, Gordon sings it and the rest of them all come in on the back. And it's a great tune and I love it, but I couldn't necessarily distinguish. I'm sure people who have seen Fish 150 or 200 times could sit there and tell you about how their voices sound and whether their voices are too scratchy or not, or whatever it might be. And that can give it away. But, you know, definitely with the Dead, you have those little markers. That's great. You know, you're the first guest that we've talked about with.
It's true. It almost makes it easier to chronicle or for education purposes as you're going back the different eras of the band.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. And I haven't thought about it so much. I've seen Fish a lot, got off on Fish plenty. But with me, there's the Grateful Dead. And then there is everybody else.
Right.
Like that's
no doubt.
And I sometimes almost wished it was different because I could have seen them more. I had friends who they went full boat Fish. And I was like, I get it. It's rocking. I love it. But it ain't the same for me. And I don't know.
Nor for me. I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I mean, now I go back and I'm listening to the Fish station. They're playing all these shows from the late 80s, early 90s. And it's like, wow. I mean, this was a band that was really coming of age right at a point in time when I was perfectly positioned to have stepped in and seen all of that.
Yeah.
But I was still seeing 20 Dead shows a year, you know, and with a wife and kids, all of a sudden, you know, you get to a point where you don't quite have that same luxury unless you're my son, Matthew's good friend, Kevin, who somehow has a couple of kids, but manages to get out and see every freaking show in the world. His wife is a saint. I don't know how he does it, but you know, more power to him. Right. But I mean, otherwise it's,
yeah,
you reach a point that I didn't have the ability to catch both of them. And so I used all my points to go see, you know, the Grateful Dead. And then after, you know, Jerry died and it stopped, it was kind of hard. I think, you know, there was a part of me that felt like I wasn't glad or relieved that that he had died and that they had stopped playing, but it's like anything else in life. All of a sudden you're like, wow, look at all this additional time I have that I'm not spending running off to Grateful Dead shows, right? And it was like, no, I'm not doing anything this weekend. You know, normally we'd be in, you know, Las Vegas at the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl, but not anymore. Let's go do something. And, you know, I tell you, know, I was the Bull season ticket holder until recently. And, you know, same thing, you know, my wife, everybody knew, you know, May and June, Bulls playoffs, we're not going anywhere. And then Michael Jordan retired and, you know, the Bulls sucked. They weren't even in the playoffs. And, you know, all of a sudden it was like, wow, May and June are wide open for these are good travel months. Who knew? Right. So let me ask you this, Christian. 100%. Tell me a little bit about your musical background, because clearly, you know, you have some connections to music, and what are they, and you know, what's really gotten you going in music?
So I grew up, you know, my mom listened to Dire Straits, Clapton, Le Hendrix. So that I had that little bit of a foundation, but I was a Parrothead. I was Jimmy. At one point, Jimmy Buffett, when I was in my teens, I wanted to party and it was,
sure.
It was Jimmy Buffett and I was a champion.
Cheeseburger in paradise, baby.
and then caught a Dead, you know, went to a couple Dead shows, did my freshman year of college at Tulane and it was worse than that. And it was, right, it was 90, mid 90s, 94, drinking Connecticut hard, you know, 21 and strict. And then I moved here and I could have a large pizza, six pack of beer and a pint of Jack Daniels delivered to my dorm room
right at
midnight.
Yep.
I had no chance. And so I had gotten exposed a little bit to some more New Orleans music, and actually Fish played right next to my dorm in McAllister. Would have been either fall of 94 or spring of 95. And we met them outside. I mean, it was a couple thousand people and they were outside mingling with everybody. And I, you know, I'd seen a couple of shows or whatever. And my, you know, said dumb stuff.
Sure.
So after my 1 year at Tulane, before they told me it might be good to take a break, I was living in Boston and probably partially depressed, trying to figure out everything. I, you know, might have had Bill might have sent me some stuff from Arizona, and that was the guy I was at the show with. And you know, I had some buddies that left. So I'm in a new apartment, no TV. I had a black leather Lazy Boy, and my buddies had left a cassette tape. Chapel Hill, March 24th, 93. And I'm just listening to it, miserable. And then all of a sudden, as I'm just it just kind of goes like this, and it would all, everything made sense, and it was just like fish hook, done. And then for the next decade, all I did was listen to the Grateful Dead. I didn't do anything else. And
it's not a bad way to spend a decade.
right. And then, you know, as I'm growing up, up until I had my first kid in 2007, I probably listened 90%+ Grateful Dead. Then, just like all good, and this was my musical experience. I was not playing any instruments. And then he was born, we moved to New Orleans. So I'm back in here. But, you know, there's you know, Jazz Fest and all this other kind of stuff going on. Long story, trying to get to the short of it. I quit drinking about 4 years ago. COVID hit. I picked up a bass guitar. I bought the cheapest amp, because I didn't know if they were going to be, if it was going to be for 2 days or what I was going to do. And I just kept going. And, you know, my God, putting on Jerry Garcia Band and playing and listening. It's, you hear the crowd and you're like, oh my God, they love me. And it was the most fun I've ever had in my life. There was nothing else I would rather do. Nothing. And then, you know, but I'm playing bass and I'm like, why? I can't, you know, it's not an acoustic guitar. If you're playing bass, you got to be playing with people. And then I did an open mic, met some amazing people, everybody I've met has been supportive and encouraging. And then played with some dad's friends I knew, and it was great. And I said, but Christian, we really think this is going to be an upright. I'm like, upright. I'm like fighting for survival with this thing. I finally rented an upright. There was another crazy singing group that is hard to explain in any kind of short period of time that I was in. And they needed my truck. And I said, sure. I just got to, let me put this bass in here. I said, oh, why do you have that bass? I said, well, I'm going to learn how to play it. I said, well, why don't you play it tonight? So we had a show, and I'm like, okay. And now I'm in two bands. I can't stop playing. Practice it all the time. People paid to see me play. I haven't left, and it's been an amazing freaking journey.
That's great fun. You know, my mom always said, learn to play an instrument. You'll love to do it when you're adult. And I never listened to her. Now I'm adult, and I wish I had. So, you know, you give
it. It's not too late, Larry.
No, it's true.
It's not too
right.
late.
That's true.
You know, you can just get a few chords. And I mean, we played. We went down to a corporate event, not very corporate, but it was a corporate event. And we went down, we played, and we said, guys, listen, if we do it for us, if we can get off on it, that's all we can ask. And they're either along for the ride or they're not. I pulled out a bow. I don't even know how to hold a bow. We played Lou Reed's Heroin for 8 minutes with a bow. It's two chords. It went right into Fire on the Mountain. Two more chords. 15 minutes of music, four chords. It's and because it's all about energy, heart, and it's not, nobody's gonna play with me because I'm a virtuoso, because I miss that work. I miss that book.
All right, but no, I understand. Well, you know, Dan Humiston, man, he drives a rough ship over here. We don't always have time to, you know, to break away and play all that music like we'd like to. Someday down the road, when I can finally, you know, like Jim Marty managed to retire, we'll see what he does one day. But right, but I love that you're talking about the stand-up bass, because that's a great lead into the next clip we're going to play from our show from August 4th, 1994. And now what we're going to do is we're going to get into a streak the rest of the way here of new Grateful Dead music. I look to see eternity. You cannot think of eternity bigger than it. Try to be. Thank you. So yes, Eternity is one of the what we would always call the newer Grateful Dead tunes, because first there was Touch of Grey, then there was the whole Built to Last situation, and then finally we got into these songs that they were playing in the mid to late 90s that never made it onto an album. So, you know, this was a new Bob Weir song, but it's really got a fascinating history because it was written by Bob. The music was written by Bob along with Rob Wasserman, who was a stand-up bass player and played with Bob a lot in Rat Dog, as well as playing with a number of other famous musicians. But more importantly, and I'm going to confess, I never knew this before, the lyrics for Eternity were written by none other than Willie Dixon. And
which blew my mind when I saw that. I had no idea either. And I mean, he was a freak of nature.
Yeah, and
in a positive way, obviously.
Just amazing, right? So they first played it in February of 93 out in Oakland. It wound up being played 44 times. It was last played, the second to last show, July 8th, 95 at Soldier Field. And although it never came out on an album, it was one of these songs included in the Dead's first post-Jerry box set called So Many Roads. You know, we thought that the title of the song was very apt for what the song was, and it did seem to kind of take an eternity for Bob to sing his way through it. And, you know, I don't feel entirely bad saying that we never really developed much of an affection for this song, because I'm not aware of Bobby having even played it anymore. I've seen him with Wolf Brothers. I've seen Dead and Company. He covers Jerry all the time on his Wolf, you know, right. Some of the other tunes that Jerry did as well. But he doesn't play this one. And I'm like, hey, man, this is your tune. You know, you should be out there playing it and really getting stuff going on it. And, you know, he didn't. But you know, he did do a lot of stuff with Rob Wasserman. And although I never saw Rat Dog with Rob Wasserman and feel bad about that, but they really worked well together. And this is a great example of that. Willie Dixon, though, is the fascinating one, because this was written right at the very end of his life. He died in 1992, and this song came out. They first started playing it in 93. And, you know, but Willie is really, I think you have to say, one of the preeminent blues songwriters or performers we've ever had. And the Grateful Dead were no stranger to Willie Dixon's tunes. They played Down at the Bottom, I Ain't Superstitious, I Just Want to Make Love to You, which, by the way, was also played by Foghat. For a long time, I thought it was Foghat's song because I had never heard anybody else play it until somebody clued me in that, no, it was actually a Willie Dixon tune after the Dead played it. Little Red Rooster, which we all heard once every third show throughout the 1980s. The Same Thing, Spoonful, which we never heard enough, and Wang Dang Doodle, which they were guaranteed to play if they came into Chicago. But these are all Willie Dixon songs, and for a lot of Deadheads, they just look at them as, oh, this is just part of the Grateful Dead's repertoire. But it only was in the context of them being cover songs. But Bob Weir, you know, when talking about this particular song with Willie Dixon, he goes, I had this chord progression and melody that I wanted to run by Willie to see if he liked it. So we don't all have access to a guy like Willie Dixon to just run some music by and see if he likes it. But Bob did, so credit him for doing it. And Willie liked what he saw, so he started dashing off some words. He wanted me to run a certain section by him again and stuff like that. And we started working on a bridge. Then he dashes off this sheet of lyrics and hands it to me. Now I'm really stoked to be working with the legendary Willie Dixon, and I'm prepared for just about anything. He hands these lyrics to me, and I'm reading through them, and they seem, you know, awfully simplistic, like there wasn't a whole lot to them. Now he wants me to read through it and sing the melody I have and see if they fit. And so I started singing through these simplistic lyrics, and that simplicity takes on a whole other direction. By the time I had sung through them, it's like my head is suddenly eons wide. I can hear what's been happening just sort of echoing around in there. I'm astounded by the simple grace of what he has just presented to me. I'm sitting there with my mouth open, literally, and Willie's laughing. He's just sitting there laughing, saying, now you see it, now you see it. That's the wisdom of the blues. So first of all, that was an explanation that was an eternity. So, you know, Bob really has a way with words. But when you stop and listen to what he's saying, it's amazing on two levels. One, because I don't write songs and really have any knowledge about how to write music, and you know, the fact that there's people that have the ability to do that always amazes me, because without them we wouldn't have any of this great stuff. But the second part, as we've said, is, you know, that he's sitting here basically changing notes back and forth with a legend. I mean, really one of the greatest legends of all time. And, you know, as a Deadhead, that makes me, you know, proud, because Willie Dixon, you know, he was popular enough, he could have worked with any musicians he wanted to work with. And the fact that, you know, he gave the Dead so much time and attention and was willing, you know, to be not just accessible to a guy like Bob Weir, but, you know, to literally work with him on crafting some songs, has to speak to the fact that he must have really liked the way that they played his other tunes. And, you know, that's one of those stories that I really love hearing about. And, you know, it kind of puts the song in a whole new image. I can't say so much that if they were coming back for one night, I'd want that in the set list.
Right.
But if they were back, you know, kind of full time and we were going to be seeing them on a regular basis, I wouldn't mind if they threw it in every now and then.
Right, right. No, that's immediately you got me starting to think if putting together that set list, did you have to make it in where it would fall during the set, or could it just be how you're going to fill it? But yeah, but Willie Dixon, in my last year of studying for the upright, certainly one of the names that came up, and there's some great old, I love some of the old videos of him, the old black and white ones. I mean, he's a mountain of a man, and he plucked it. It doesn't look the same like when I'm playing it, and
it never does.
But he was a, you know, he was one of those guys that was just, he was a force. It was, and I'm sure he appreciated that the Grateful Dead had something similar, right? They were just, it was a force of energy, and he had it, and they had it, and
yep.
Certainly rooted a lot in the blues, anyhow. So
I think that's very true. You know, just because the Dead were going to do it this particular night, boy, they really piled it on. So, you know, they went actually right before this, Jerry did a Standing on the Moon, and a first set Standing on the Moon, to me was always tremendous. And, excuse me, not Standing on the Moon, So Many Roads. He did a first set, So Many Roads, right before the Eternity. And then, closing out the trio of new tunes is this next cut. Dan, if you'll run this one. So, you know, if you were like a Deadhead that kind of hopped off the bus somewhere, you know, early 90s, you'll be forgiven for not having any clue what this is, other than the fact that it is Phil Lesh singing, which is kind of hard to miss as a childhood's end.
Yeah.
And it was the quote unquote new Phil tune. They each had their own new tune, as we saw in this concert. They're jamming right through them. This one was first played in July of 94 at Deer Creek. It was only made it into the concert repertoire 11 times, but somehow managed to hang on and was played at the final show at Soldier Field on July 9th, 1995. Never made it to a studio album. And interestingly enough, it is the last original Grateful Dead song to enter the live repertoire. And it's written and sung by Phil Lesh. So, you know,
there's a trivia question.
Yeah, hats off to Phil. Well, you know, and maybe so, right? Because Box of Rain was the last song they played. So, you know, Phil, every now and then, he knows when to step in and do it. I saw a great article about this from John Hilgard at 4CP Comics. And he says the background story is that Lesh and perhaps the others felt that new songs would help to fuel Garcia's engagement in a period when Jerry was headed in the same direction as in the mid-1980s, when his drugged-out bad health put him in a coma that he narrowly survived, living on to drive the 1989 onward renaissance of the band. In the 1995 remake, Jerry died. The big musical difference between those two episodes is that everyone else in the band had their shit together in 1994, whereas the whole band was a mess in 1986. So John's general take on the post-Brent 1990s Dead is that they were not to be dismissed. A band that had stopped depending on Garcia's leadership to determine the musical outcome, but who were always, therefore, also ready when Garcia was feeling spry. Weir has said something to that effect, and when Garcia was feeling spry, it was just as you wish it would be. And yeah, I mean, that's very true. I think that's absolutely true. On any given night in the mid to late 90s, Jerry could come in and just be on the top of his game, and we'd have as much fun as we had been having in the 80s. And You know, it's a great song in the sense that I love that Phil was writing songs. I can't say it was a great song in the sense that I really liked to hear it, but, you know, it just showed me that, you know, I mean, if a guy like Phil Lesh is still writing songs, you know, that far into it, it sounds like, you know, everybody's happy or at least content to keep working together.
I think, and why should they stop writing, right? I mean, the whole band was based on experimentation and anything goes at any time, like, it would be criminal to stop. It doesn't mean, you know, they could shelve it and put a pin in it and maybe wait and, you know, let it figure itself out, let it develop on its own. So, you know, certain songs certainly don't hit home the way that so many others do. And, you know, that's not one that I happen to, you know, maybe I should listen to more. I don't know. It just, I don't find it. It doesn't come up in what I listen to. And, you know, I haven't heard it too many times on Sirius.
No, I was going to say, right, I've yet to be driving along. Oh, look, they just put on Childhood's End, right? You know, it maybe they'll play a show that it pops up in, but, you know, otherwise that's about it. And it's interesting, right, because some of, you know, Jerry's last final tunes, you know, that never made it onto albums are lionized by these guys. They love Days Between. They love Liberty. They love, you know, some of these songs to the point where Bobby plays them with Dead & Co. and with the Wolf Brothers and all of this Jerry stuff that, you know, we think of as the really new Jerry stuff. And I'll tell you, I never really got behind Liberty very much either. It seemed a little too overly simplistic for me. The lyrics weren't really as clever as some of the other stuff. And, you know, I felt it was kind of like an end of career effort to, you know, to keep something going. But, you know, I mean, I respect people who that's the music that they grew up on hearing the Dead play Liberty is that's significant for them. And you know, I can appreciate that. But even Phil has not played Childhood's End all that much, you know, in his Phil and Friends rotations, you know, probably pops up every now and then. But he's too busy playing, you know, Mason's Children and, you know, the 11 and all the good, you know, really old Grateful Dead stuff. We all hoped they would keep playing, but, you know, Jerry decided he didn't want to do it anymore and didn't. But, you know, I recognize Phil for what he was. He wrote some of the greatest Grateful Dead tunes. Like Box of Rain has to be up there in everybody's top five of Grateful Dead songs for sure. And, you know, it was such an integral part of the band musically that, you know, look, Phil wants to write songs. I say, that's great, man. He must be in a good mood. Good for him.
Yeah. You know, I look, when COVID hit, I picked up the bass. And the one and only reason I picked up the bass is because when I'm listening to the Dead, it is, I am riding Phil. And there is, I don't try and play like him at all, you know, or pretend to even do whatever, but that is why I picked it up, right? And so to me, you know, whether we're talking contribution, I mean, obviously it's immeasurable, but it reminds me of, I had a good, one of my closest friends, girl lives in LA and she's married and her husband is a very talented musician and was a big Deadhead and played with some of the cover bands and we hadn't met and he couldn't propose until she had met me and so they come into New Orleans and we are fast friends right away, right? Just like this, everything's good and you know, we're 4 days in, they're hanging out and going nuts and he's over the house and I have a picture of Phil on the wall and you know, and somehow the discussion was, well, clearly, you know, you could, it was the Dead, it was Jerry and then, but you know, they couldn't have been the Grateful Dead without Phil. It's like, yeah. And he said, well, it's the same way without Bobby. I'm like, it's not even close. And he's such a Bobby Camp guy and I'm such a Phil Camp guy. And I'm like, who are you? How are you marrying this guy? You know, like, it is like, you're a Bobby guy? Oh my God. But I love them all almost equally. But maybe I have some more favorites than others.
Look, you know, everybody does, you know, I mean, I love Phil too, but I was always a Jerry guy. Rob Hunt, my co-host, and I will often say that on any given night, I'd be just as happy to see the Jerry Garcia band as the Grateful Dead.
Oh, yes.
And just, you know, jam with Jerry all night long, his music, his songs. It's, you know, he doesn't have to trade off songs or anything.
No pressure, his energy. It is.
Yeah, it was always great. But, you know, look, Bobby, like every other part of the Dead, you know, I think is something, you know, that you begin to, you begin to acquire a taste for and a deeper appreciation for as you go on. Now, I'm not going to lie, you know, again, my actual musical knowledge is fairly limited, but, you know, when you start reading stories and hearing people talk about, you know, that Bobby wasn't just your ordinary rhythm guitar player, right? That he really mastered the craft and, you know, he really learned how to fill in the holes with Jerry and was a perfect complement to him. And, you know, that was kind of stuff that I always just took for granted, but you can't just take it for granted. And, you know, Bobby is a showman in his own way. He may not always sing the songs the way I like him to sing them, but it's his man, not mine. He's entitled to sing him any damn way he wants. And, you know, he rarely disappoints. You know, he will come out and he'll put on the show that people want to hear and he'll do his thing. But I'm not going to disagree with your underlying premise, which is, you know, again, you know, if I had my way, I would tear this whole building down and, of course, you know, have nothing but, you know, Jerry, Sugar Magnolia. Sugar Magnolia playing in the band.
Yeah.
Those songs you can play all freaking day. Lost Sailor, Saint of Circumstance, love that.
Yeah.
Weather Report Suite, amazing. You know, and what else? I mean, Cassidy's a great tune. I mean, you know, there's so many of his songs that...
I've gone back and forth with that one myself. And yeah, that's what I think about it. I have my own journeys with individual songs of the Grateful Dead. And... It blows my mind. That doesn't happen with anybody else. There's nobody else's music I'm listening to. So many songs that just, that, you know, I've gone on emotional roller coasters with. And so that clearly, it's got to mean something. And clearly it does.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, we've talked about it on this show before a lot, which is, you know, that I think that Bobby somewhere in the early 80s and then onward, you know, really he became the front man for the band, right? He was the one who'd say, we'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks for coming out. That, you know, rarely, if ever, would Garcia say, even say a word, let alone, you know, really purposefully communicate with the audience. And, you know, Bobby filled that role great, you know, not fade away while the rest of the band might be falling asleep. Bobby's up in front, jumping up and down about it, having a Cadillac and this and that, and throwing his arms out. And, you know, you appreciate that energy, you know, at those moments in those shows when they're really kicking it. It's great to see that the guys in the band are having a good time. And, you know, on those rare occasions when Jerry would, you know, sway back and forth a little bit and, you know, we'd all, look, Garcia's dancing. Isn't this amazing? You know, but with Bobby, it was just a given. Yeah. And it had to be. Somebody needed to be that role.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the perfect foil for Garcia.
And he was always the pretty boy. He was always that face. He brought a different quirky energy that was vital to the whole
Absolutely.
Thing. I mean, it's, you know, I live in New Orleans. Everything's a gumbo.
Right.
And that's what that was. And his spice and his thing was certainly vital. You know, the cutoff jean shorts, that's probably not for everybody, but it was, you know, whatever.
Worked for him, and now he wears the capris. Look, I'm, you know, very happy. It's, having daughters has been a wonderful influence on him, and you know, and that's a great thing too, to see that. Let me just, we're not going to have too much time, but I just want to touch really quickly. Tell us a little bit about what's going on down in New Orleans music wise, and where you go when you're in New Orleans, and, you know, you just want to, you know, go see some great jamming and hang out.
Yep. So I moved almost exactly 2 years ago. I mean, not far. Uptown New Orleans is—it's a bubble. I mean, it's not. I don't put a lot of miles on my car every year. But I am walking distance now to Tipitina's, which is an iconic club down here that I started going to when I was at Tulane.
That's why I said before, every Tulane person winds up walking into Tipitina's. They all fall in love with the Radiators and you hear about it forever.
Yeah. And then what's amazing here too is because it's not a big town, you're walking around, you've seen these musicians everywhere. Like, they have kids, they're people too. And these are guys that I, you know, looked, I worshiped when I was younger, and now, like, you know, they can become friends, and it's amazing. And that's something that you get here. So much of this, you know, it feels like a big city to some people, but it's really a small town. And there's so much good music here. But Tipitina's is not 5-7 days a week. The guys from Galactic own Tipitina's now. So I'm there, you know, a couple times a month. I especially now going to see this upright. Peter Harris is an upright bass guy who plays at the Pontchartrain Hotel like 4 days a week. And it's free to get in. He has, I mean, from Stanton Moore, Jason Marsalis, Johnny Vidal. I mean, Everybody comes in and plays with them, rotating, and it's free to get in. You can get good drinks. It's more adult than a lot of the places that I used to go to. But those kind of things, I mean, go to the Maple Leaf. George Porter still plays once a week. You can go there on Monday nights with Johnny Vadakkan, like $15 to get in, and you're watching legends play. So pick the night, and there's still a lot of good stuff to go see here in New Orleans. And I think what's exciting is I think there's more. There's a lot of commonality in the energy and improvisation of New Orleans music and Grateful Dead world, but those worlds did not come together too well too often, and it was almost like they were separate. You know, there's not a lot of there's obviously a history that the Dead has with New Orleans, but this wasn't on their rotation very much. I feel like there's more and more Grateful Dead music influence being played by a lot of, whether it's Anders, Liddell, you know, guys from the Radiators and all this kind of stuff. The Honey Island Swamp Band, you know, New Orleans, NOLA Suspects. There's just, it seems to be creeping in, and I think that's a great thing. Hearing songs played with different energy and in a lot of different ways. So it's not, you're not going to go long without hearing a Grateful Dead tune, no matter where you poke your head here in New Orleans.
No, I mean, every band you mentioned, you know, is great. You know, and I think of the Meters, I think of Trombone Shorty, you know, and some of these other guys who I've been lucky enough to see both in New Orleans and in other places when they're touring. And it is always such a distinctive sound, but more important, you know, it brings along a little sense of, hey, this is the way we do it down in New Orleans. And so we're going to bring it from there, you know, to your town tonight. And, you know, you get a chance to experience it the way they do down there. And it's always fun. I've got really good friends who live down in that part of the world. And, you know, anytime I have an excuse to go down there and say hello, strangely enough, always right around the time of Jazz Fest. But, you know,
that's amazing how that happens.
Whenever you can make it happen. Yep. You know, you go down there and, hey, guys, haven't talked to you in a while, but boy, I saw that lineup at Jazz Fest and decided this is a good time to get some beignets and do our thing. Well, that's fun too.
But Jazz Fest is, you know, I think we had it missed 2 years. It was canceled because of COVID, and it is just, it feels like it's back bigger, stronger than it's ever been. And you know, can it get too crowded? Sure. But you know, I don't need to go see all the big acts. I almost like it when everybody's going to see the big acts, because that means all the other stages are a lot easier, a lot more accessible for me.
Everybody wants to go see the Eagles. I am very, very comfortable going and seeing Dr. John and Warren Haynes. Yeah. While you guys all go see the Eagles, and we'll compare notes afterwards. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's dive back into this show one more time here, because we still haven't heard all of the new songs from all the members. So now Vinny gets his turn. Nobody could argue that the Grateful Dead weren't an egalitarian band. Here they are, you know, really on the back end of their career. They're all writing songs, and they reach out to a new guy in the band, Vince Wilnick, and say, have at it. And, you know, Vinny comes up with Way to Go Home. You know, he also did Samba in the Rain with the Dead, which was a fun tune to hear him play. And, you know, Vinny just was a victim of bad timing. He's a great guy. Obviously had a very strong musical career before getting to the Dead. And, you know, I love the way that they let him write some songs and get them out there. But what really impresses me about this song is the guys that he wrote it with, Bob Breilove, and the lyrics are by Robert Hunter. Now, you know, by this point in his career, Hunter could, you know, just kind of sit back in his rocking chair and be resting his laurels. But, you know, he saw a guy coming into the band who he thought had a creative flair and, you know, took the time to sit down and crank out some lyrics for him. And, you know, anytime you have a song where the lyrics are written by Robert Hunter, you know, it's up to the musician to blow it. And Vinny doesn't do it here. You know, he really played it strong. This one debuted February 23rd, 92 in Oakland at the Coliseum. They actually wound up playing it 92 times, which I think is pretty significant for a Vince Welnick tune over the last few years of the band. And this one was last played on June 28th, 95 at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Just for people who don't know or need a refresher, Bob Breilove is a keyboard synthesizer player who worked as a sound technician with the Grateful Dead from 86 to 95. Throughout his tenure, he performed as an auxiliary musician throughout Drums and Space, the band's signature, you know, music segments always coming in the middle of the second set. And he also played a key role in their integration of MIDI, M-I-D-I technology, which stands for Musical Instrumentation Digital Interface, which allows all sorts of electronic instruments and recorders and amps and everything to all work with one another, and leave it to guys like Mickey Hart and Bill Kreutzmann working with Bob Breilove, you know, and even Brent Midland and Bob Weir to really work all of this in to the Grateful Dead sound in the late 80s and early 90s. He also co-wrote other Grateful Dead songs, including Picasso Moon, Way to Go Home, Easy Answers. You know, again, somebody who came in and had one purpose ostensibly in the band, but was so talented that they were able to use him in a lot of different places.
I was just going to say, somebody was a good coach. You got somebody who's here, who's on the team, and he's got something extra. Let's find something else for him to do. Sorry. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And they did a great job with all of it. You know, Breilove also was part of the psychedelic keyboard trio along with Vince Welnick and former Grateful Dead keyboardist Tom Constantin. They collaborated as Dos Hermanos, a lot of other improvisational keyboard work. They toured somewhat irregularly, but Breilove was also busy working with Stevie Wonder. This is just always an amazing cast of characters that wind up somehow interfacing into the Grateful Dead musical universe. And, you know, kudos to Vince for, even during his short time with the band, you know, kind of figuring out who these guys were and, you know, attracting their attention where they were willing to give him the time. And good for them, you know, to be egalitarian in that way and not just give, well, we're here to work with Jerry. We don't really have time to work with the rest of you. And, you know, it's certainly a song that played well for the Grateful Dead. And, you know, it helps secure Vince's legacy in the band to some degree. And anybody who plays with the Grateful Dead should have a legacy. And, you know, like I say, I like Vinny and I'm glad he got his.
Yeah, it's, you know, I agree. He's not as, just as many of the things that you just said on how people, you know, either perceive or analyze his time with it. Just looking at these songs that you add here or these newer tunes, you know, Eternity and Childhood's End, Way to Go Home. I know which song has made it more into my sphere out of those. And even not to play a spoiler for what you have coming up, except for that time in Chicago, which I think elevated it for a lot of people. This is the song, it's Vince's song that was most relevant to me.
Yeah. Days Between is a wonderful tune. We'll get to it in one second. This was another of, you know, the new, you know, Jerry tunes, if you will. Again, first played in February of 93 out in Oakland. The Dead managed to get to it 42 times and was last played in June of 95 at RFK in one of the final shows of that summer tour, ultimately culminating in Soldier Field. It clearly has become a favorite of the surviving band members. They played it the third night at the 50th anniversary shows at Soldier Field. It's been frequently played by Dead & Co. with Bobby singing. It's also been played by Bob and Wolf Brothers, by Phil and Friends. It's a great tune to end this episode, and it's just a great tune all the way around. David Dodd, who also did a lot of work with the Grateful Dead, wrote about Days Between, that it's come to be an anthem that makes us remember Garcia in a particular way, and in particular, the days between his birth date of August 1 and his death date of August 9. It's a fitting song for such thoughts, with its big sweeping chords and its lyrics heavy with nostalgia and longing. There's a word in German, which I won't pronounce correctly, but Sehnsucht, that lacks the proper emotional counterpart in English, but which means roughly longing, carrying a sense of wishing you could see something, that something is missing from your eyes and from your presence. I find that Days Between belongs with a raft of songs that induce this feeling for me. It's a late song in the Robert Hunter Garcia songbook, perhaps their last great collaboration on a big significant song, one that has to rank with Dark Star and Terrapin Station, as ambitious and intentionally grand about it. And during its relatively short run in the live repertoire, they still got to it, as you say, 40 times, always in the second set, mostly always coming out of drums. And Phil Lesh had this to say about it: I don't know whether to weep with joy at the beauty of the vision or with sadness at the impassable chasm of time between the golden past and the often painful present. And yeah, we're very shortly going to be coming up on to the days between these 8 or 9 days that really symbolize a lot for Deadheads and Garcia fans and anybody who loves this kind of music. And Days Between was definitely a tune that had to grow on you. You know, the first couple of times it was, you know, kind of slow, and Garcia maybe not have been at the top of his game. But you're right. I think that we're doing it in 2015, really kind of put it on a whole nother level for people and caused a lot of us to go back and really reassess our feelings about the song and the way that Jerry played it. And, you know, then you kind of hit your head like, wow, you know, if I hadn't been there so concerned that he wasn't playing Morning Dew, you know, I might have really enjoyed him doing this, because he had the emotion in his voice and the ability to really, you know, take this song and make it great. So we're going to listen to this in 1 second. But just really quickly, Christian, I just want to say thank you so much for being on the podcast today. This has been great. I've enjoyed our conversation. It's always fun to talk with a guy who loves the Grateful Dead, loves good music, knows all about New Orleans music. And my guy, we never even got to cannabis. So we'll save that for the next time you're on. And, you know, we can talk about all the joy that people get out of that as well.
Maybe it's a Jazz Fest podcast in New Orleans.
Ooh.
Next year. A location podcasting recording.
I love that. You know, I'm going to have to talk to Dan about the travel budget, though, and see if see if that's something that's in the cards for this scraggly group, even though we might have to take you up on it anyway. But thank you for being on. We really appreciate it. You added a lot, and really appreciate the insight, both as it relates to the Grateful Dead and just musically overall. So thank you, and please plan to come back again sometime, because we'd love to have you. And so, yeah, otherwise, in closing out, I will just say to everyone, listen, have a great week. Be happy that Fish's tour came out. By the way, anybody who's old enough to really appreciate it, go to YouTube and check out the cover version they did the last night in Alpharetta, Georgia, of the Vicki Lawrence tune, The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia, from way back when she was still on the Carol Burnett Show. And the fact that Fish played it was great. It doesn't sound very good, but they're playing it. And so, you know, that's absolutely a lot of fun. Dave's Picks 47 from St. Louis in December 1979. My brother Jeff went to that show. He's never seen a Dead show since, but he loves telling it.
Where was it?
St. Louis Kiel Auditorium, December 79.
I got married at the Fox Theater in St. Louis. And during the wedding, I got to go on the stage, do my Jerry pose.
Yep, Fox Theater. We'll come back and we'll talk about that too. That's another one of our favorite stories. But yeah, no, just a quick shout out to my brother Jeff, because he did see the Grateful Dead before I in December 79. So he was actually at this show, and I'm going to have to get him a copy of it. For everybody else, thank you. Continue to enjoy your summer. Make the most of it. Be safe and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Here's Jerry. Like a golden moon, the finest ever seen. Runs of darkness, still tender yet unbreaking. Left on shelves. Not
fly between, fly between.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Are you looking for the next great cannabis business to invest in? Then you need to check out the MJ Bulls podcast. Hi, I'm Dan Humiston. Join me each week as I speak to both cannabis entrepreneurs who are raising capital and cannabis investors who are investing capital. Our 10-minute episodes are perfect for the busy investor. Start listening to the MJ Bulls podcast today, wherever you listen to podcasts, and who knows, maybe you'll discover the next cannabis unicorn.